You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 15th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24. Coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Sophie Grove. Coming up on today's programme, we're joined in the studio by filmmaker Mark Radice, who'll be reviewing his pick of documentaries, including Werner Herzog's series Death Row and Spike Lee's treatment of the 25th anniversary of Michael Jackson's album Bad.
Whenever he made that connection with people, the molecules changed.
He begged me, please don't do another take.
Just run through the lines.
I still don't know how he did that thing.
We'll also be taking a look at what you could be getting up to this weekend if you happen to find yourself in San Francisco.
You can go skating on Union Square in the shade of palm trees and grab an ice cream on one of the not infrequent warm days. You can also enjoy an array of enticing performances and events.
And we'll be reviewing music with Strut Records from Christmas Groove to Metal Dance. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Plenty to pack in then, but Sophie, what's been the highlight of your cultural week this week? It's been an unusual thing in terms of culture. I think we're talking about it in the loosest possible sense.
I know, it's been quite a gastronomic cultural week for me. I seem to have dined out every night in London in the most Christmassy venues I could think of. So I started the week at Galvin's around the corner, then I was in Jay Shiki, I was in the Wolseley, all these kind of shiny, sort of cosy little spots in London, which I almost reserve for this time of year. But it wasn't that cultural. I did accidentally sort of bypass the Royal Academy about three times when I was doing my Christmas shopping.
I think it's allowed
down in Piccadilly.
I managed to embrace that side of the of life as well as the more highbrow. I went on a Dickens tour of London.
Oh, wow.
So I went around the Inns of Court over in Holborn, which is always, you know, it's always beautiful to wander around there. And of course the whole Dickens tour was trying to explain. It was actually quite a bit of a letdown, actually, because you had a man who would just point up at a window and go, "And that's where Pip stayed in Great Expectations." And that was it. And then we'd move on and he'd go, "And that's where Dickens worked for 3 years and threw cherry pips out of a window." And by the end of it, you'd looked at a lot of very beautiful windows, but hadn't really felt a sort of a great feeling of any true engagement with the author. He did take us to the Cheshire Cheese pub, though, on Fleet Street, which had its own particular charms. Very beautiful old pub, renovated in the 18th century. They haven't really done much more with it. They have, in fact, got sawdust on the floor, which I haven't seen before, without it being a bit of a tourist ploy. But what I did do is go home and I read A Christmas Carol, and I had completely forgotten that it is only 95 pages long. So you can feel as if you're getting your literary fix very quickly. And it's great to go back to reading it again. It is something that I haven't read since I was a teenager, and I had completely forgotten what a good writer Dickens was.
It's amazing. We met this wonderful woman who's the official historian for Fortnum & Mason this week, and she was saying that the Christmas Carol actually made Christmas because people started emulating exactly what they'd seen in it, and it more or less sort of defined what you should do. It was like a manual for what to buy and how to sort of Christmas, really.
Christmas in Britain, at least, had been banned by Oliver Cromwell. And after Cromwell had gone, Christmas was reinstated, but had completely lost the gloss of you know, after it had been banned, its reinstatement was never quite as successful. And as you say, Dickens' combination of the poor and the rich and the luxury and the sense of redemption and celebration that you get at Christmas nowadays only, as you say, came through because of A Christmas Carol. 95 pages, which changed our complete perception of how we celebrate.
I love the way we haven't done so many cultural things, but we've definitely been thinking Christmas through this cerebral Christmas
day. I've embraced Christmas marvellously, both culturally, obviously, because of my 95-page novel, but also I've been making tons of mince pies. Don't know why. It's one of those things. Anyway, what an exciting week we've all been having, Sophie. The time is 8 minutes past the hour. You're with The Review.
Now, ask any student of journalism of the broadcast kind, at least, what they ultimately want to do, and 9 times out of 10, the answer will be to make documentaries. To many, it's the purest form of journalism.
And as a result, it's ferociously competitive. However, our first guest on today's review is a man who's carved out a successful career out of the documentary genre. I'm delighted to say Mark Radice joined us in the studio. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you
so much for coming in. Explain to us some of the documentaries of yours that we may or may have seen.
Well, I've done a mix of what's called in the industry specialist factual, which is historical or scientific, or sometimes a mix of both. I've just been doing the new Andrew Marr series, which was on the BBC, a version of which is going out in the States, which is about the history of the world, so it doesn't really get any bigger as subjects go. But what else have I done? I've done Headhunters in Borneo, Earthquake Prediction, The Hope Diamond, which is a huge blue diamond in Washington. So a variety of subjects.
How do you go about choosing your subjects? Because you've obviously chosen things which are not necessarily of one particular subject matter.
Which is partly deliberate, because I would get bored if I kept doing the same thing. Often one gets attached as a director. I'm a freelance director, and you speak to people, and I generally, so far in my career, have had choice. You know, if I don't find something that sounds interesting, I wait and something else comes along. Hopefully that continues, you know. And then otherwise, I mean, sometimes a few things have been my own ideas, and they've just been stories that are interesting, and then trying to find a way of telling that story.
And to what extent is your work sort of investigative? Do you start with this kernel of an idea and then really sort of strip it away and work on it over a series of months or years? Can you give us a sense of, you know, how you go about researching your work?
Well, it depends on the subject. Sometimes they aren't really that investigative. Sometimes it's more a slice of life. It's more an interesting story that you're bringing to life for the small or big screen and stuff. I mean, got to remember as well that there's pictures as well. You know, you have to think of a way of characters, pictures, locations, that bringing that kind of thing to life, because, you know, if it was just a film about buses, that wouldn't be very interesting. But if there's an interesting person who is on the bus, then it becomes more interesting. In terms of stripping things away and I did a film a few years ago on the assassination of a Bulgarian dissident, Georgi Markov, who was killed by poisoned umbrella on Waterloo Bridge. It's quite a famous story from the Cold War. And then there was, going to Bulgaria, meeting people, meeting journalists, unpicking things. And I mean, often it's quite a gradual thing. I don't take years, but I don't have years to do these things.
Are you a secret camera man? Do you ever film sort of undercover, as it were? Is that not your style?
I've never done undercover filming. It's not really the kind of films I've made. I mean, it's quite tricky, you know, because generally there needs to be a good reason to film undercover. And actually, with the technology now, there's much more you can do with glasses, cameras in glasses, lapels, and things like that. But it's not really the kind of thing I've done.
Do you, when you're embarking upon a documentary, and I'm thinking of the Andrew Marr documentary from a few weeks ago, when it's absolutely clear that before you've even stepped out of the office, your script is written and your links are written, and you know, you get the sense that the structure is already being in place before you go. Have you ever found yourself in a completely opposite situation where you've gone off to do a documentary about one thing and then discovered something that absolutely knocked you sideways?
Well, all the time, and I hate to say things aren't set in stone as
oh, really?
That. You know, I mean, firstly, I'd say films are very collaborative. You know, although I am the director and I like to think of myself as the apex of the pyramid, you know, my editor, my director of photography, researchers, anyone can bring something to the table and often do. And I do think with documentary, much more than feature films or drama, actually the script is just a starting point, because there might be things that you've written in the script that turn out to be rubbish, or, as you say, there might be something really exciting that is a real game changer and stuff, and you have to be open to that all the time. Also, I would say the edit is a really important part.
That was the next point I was going to make. You, having worked in television, you find yourself trying to pare back. And I've always found that within television, it is what you leave out which is the most important thing. But when you talk to students, especially who want to go into documentary, they feel as if they have half an hour in which to throw the kitchen, you know, to throw everything at the subject. But it's not about that at all, is it?
No, I mean, and there's that's a, I mean, it's not just students that have make that mistake. I'll find, you know, esteemed executive producers as well. The whole kitchen is often thrown at the film, and actually, you know, space is a really important thing in filmmaking. And just because there's space there doesn't mean, oh, it's an opportunity to add an extra sentence or an extra fact or an extra number. Actually, space, those moments when people are thinking, looking, is often how the emotion of a film gets, you know, that's the interesting part often, you know, more interesting than the facts, I think, you know.
Do you think that documentary is starting to be appreciated as more of an art form? For instance, my favourite cinema experience this year was the Bob Marley documentary by Kevin MacDonald, and it was such a filmic experience, in, you know, sitting in the cinema for hours, and it was like 2.5 hours of these epic shots, and I feel like, you know, there's really a sense that, you know, documentaries are starting to be appreciated more as this kind of art form.
Well, definitely. I mean, and that's been, I mean, feature docs, you know, and I can't pinpoint the exact moment when the first big one came, but I'm thinking of Touching the Void or something like that. That's about 10 years ago, 8 years ago. It's a huge thing now that actually you'll find that every month there's a big feature doc that's been properly resourced and that people will go and see. I mean, there's also interesting things one can talk about, the crossing of genres, that actually some of the biggest names in documentary are now making our films. So Paul Greengrass is the classic example, who made all the Bourne films, and the Bournes 2 and 3, sorry, not all the Bourne films, and whose name is frequently mentioned in discussions, and that style, which then influenced the James Bond style. So James Bond was supposed to become more Bourne. Actually, Bourne was made by a documentary maker, and you can see that in the aesthetic. So it's an interesting crossover.
And it's interesting that the theatres and picture houses are taking these on. I mean, I was really surprised in that particular documentary I just mentioned, the MacDonald one. People stayed, hours, and then they stayed to the very end of the credits, you know, looking, poring over the work that had gone into it. And, you know, there's this captive audience of people kind of going down this old-fashioned way, really. They don't necessarily just want to watch it on the box at home.
Well, that's great. As a documentary maker. And I think, you know, actually, I think people do like, I mean, there's probably a whole other discussion to be had about how I think people like real life more now. You know, actually, as I say, you know, people criticise James Bond films for being a bit too tongue-in-cheek, although I quite like that. That's how they were supposed to be 20 years ago, and they want things to be grittier and shaky camera and out of focus and things, and that's, you know, the documentary sensibility is you're seeing more and more.
May I ask a little bit about, you were talking about the executives who want to chuck their ideas in and what have you. A lot of the way that documentaries are now put together and are funded are co-productions. So you get a co-production with either BBC Worldwide, which you know can distribute it, and then you have the likes of Channel 5, Channel 4. How much does that become a tussle in terms of editorial control over what goes into the ultimate goes into the documentary?
Well, I mean, it's always a tussle, but I mean, I'd like to, without being cheesy, I think it's a challenge as well. All of my films have been co-productions, so Channel 4, National Geographic, Discovery, PBS, you know, International. And so quite often there's little things you can do to bridge the two continents, but without being too mid-Atlantic. So quite often, so you'll have American interviewees as well. And then obviously in the different versions, you can skew something slightly more American or international, something slightly more British.
And do you?
And there's little little tricks. I remember, you know, Channel 4. This is very, very industry. This, but they're insisting always past tense, whereas in America everything's present tense. So if you're telling a historical story, you'd say, you know, 11th of September, 2011. This is happening, such and such, you know.
But which is a great device to bring absolute immediacy to your viewers and to have you on the edge of your seat, but it totally changes the feeling of a piece of film,
doesn't
it?
Absolutely, yeah.
And when you're dealing with the different executives, and I'm thinking now about the way that the documentary world probably changed quite a lot in the 1990s when everything got outsourced and people and independent production companies are springing up left, right and centre. How did the process of pitching your documentaries change? Because you hear so many people saying, I've pitched, but my idea is somewhere in a file, somewhere in the BBC, and it hasn't been looked at for 2 years.
Well, I think one of the real difficulties is that it often takes 18 months to get a film funded. And as an individual, you can't sit around for 18 months. You have to do other films and things, you know, to pay the mortgage and stuff, you know. And that's partly because everything's co-funded. You know, in 20 years ago, either British broadcasters or American broadcasters could fund a film solely, but now they don't, you know, and it's just the tariff is too small because it's expected that you'll get a certain fraction of money there, but you'll get the rest of the pie from America and Australia or something, you know.
Let's talk about some of the documentaries that you wanted to talk about here on Monocle 24. Spike Lee's new film on Michael Jackson, Bad 25. Why did you want to draw our attention to it?
I mean, partly because in terms of big documentaries, cinema release documentaries, this is one of as big as it can get, really, you know, because big name, big star, probably big budget, you know, big contributors. And it was just quite interesting seeing Spike Lee, who, I don't know, before features, but I don't think he's a documentary maker and stuff, you know.
He's done the likes of Malcolm X,
obviously,
but he's done the crossovers.
Yeah, but, you know, in terms of, I mean, he's a brilliant feature film director and I love some of his films and stuff, you know, so it's quite interesting there seeing someone coming from that stable, you know.
Let's have a quick listen to it. You knock me off of my feet now,
baby. Woo! A lot of people, they're used to just seeing the outcome. It's so much work.
Michael would say it starts in this very room and it spreads over the entire world.
Whenever he made that connection with people, the molecules changed.
He begged me, please don't do another take.
Just run through the lines. I still don't know how he did that thing.
Great stuff. I love the molecular effect of Michael Jackson, the insight there. I mean, it's really interesting to see Spike Lee dealing with a subject matter like this. I wonder, you know, do you think that he's really brought something new in terms of perspective to this subject?
I wasn't sure. I mean, I'm loath to... I mean, I really enjoyed the film, but it felt a bit like a interesting, detailed article about Michael Jackson. I didn't feel there was much of a stance, and a few things I felt could have been unpicked a bit better, but there it was. It was just a detailed description of the album, but I did like it.
It is complicated in dealing with anything that regards Jackson. Now he's not around and all the controversy that's surrounded him and his legacy. And do you think he deals with that, or is he trying to sort of look at the art form and really just look specifically about the creation of this album, you know, without any of the politics and context?
I think it was more, pretty much the latter, and it's very detailed. And also, I mean, there's some amazing interviewees, but that helps when you're a big name director and stuff, because, I mean, as you'll probably know, in Monocle, trying to get big people to appear is not off, you know, it's not the standard route of applying to their agent or something. I mean, Spike probably just texted them. It's a bit easier.
He's not been one to shy away from controversial figures. I mean, we talked a moment ago about Malcolm X. Do you think that Spike Lee was the right person to make this film?
Well, I think the thing is, it depends what film it is, and I'm loath to, you know, go, oh no, because this should have been about the warts and all or his weird sexuality or something. But it wasn't that film, you know. And then I remember years ago I've never liked film reviewers that don't know the kind of film they're reviewing. Do you know what I mean? So it'd be like someone who was reviewing a kid's film who prefers art house films and just slagging it off because it's a kid's film. It's the same as, you know, the Bad 25 was a film about the album, you know, and interviewing big names about how it was created, and it did a good job of doing that.
Let's move on to another series of documentaries that appeared in the United Kingdom earlier on this year from the director Werner Herzog. It was the film which was a sort of question and answer session among inmates on death row, where he profiled various people who were on their way to execution, and they had an exploration. Let's hear a little bit from that.
I have more time than all mass murderers in the prison system that I know of. They took away all hope for me. And when you do that to a person, anything is possible.
The worst part and the worst thing that I have to face is having someone tell me that you're guilty of a crime that I know that I was never, ever there to commit.
Werner Herzog's documentary Death Row there. The choice of Mark Radice, a documentary maker and guest on today's review. What did you think of this series?
I was gripped. I mean, I think Werner's a brilliant filmmaker, and actually it's very different to the Bad film in that when you're making a film about Michael Jackson, there's obviously a million hours of archive and he's very famous. When you're making a film about Death Row, well, pictures, well, you can't, there's no film of executions, there's no film of lots of things. So you start with a completely blank canvas. So then the question is how you fill it. What I also thought was interesting was there was much more sort of emotional content as well as facts and figures about this is X, he's on trial for X and he's dying or sentenced to death then. There's a brilliant moment in one of the films when they were using images of the journey between the holding prison and where the execution was going to take place with lakes and basically the interviewer was describing the smells and the sounds, what he could hear as he was being transported to his execution, which is just much, it's just very interesting because just in those, you know, I was saying earlier about the spaces, you know, in that kind of space, instead of just giving facts and figures, you know, I think the viewer, the audience is taken to a completely different place.
It's interesting, and you mentioned that aesthetic, because the atmosphere of these places is so powerful, even though it's completely anodyne and uninspiring in terms of, you know, light and anything that you'd expect a filmmaker to find interesting. It's rendered in such an emotional way, and you get a sense of Werner Herzog, the man. You know, he's quite present in the documentary, even as an interviewer. You kind of occasionally hear him. I wonder if that's a new thing for him.
Well, not really, because I don't know if you've seen in his other films. He's been making documentaries for 15, 20 years, and Little Dieter Needs to Fly is one of my favourite films. It's an absolutely amazing documentary, or Wings of Hope, and they're all, Werner is very much present and stuff. I mean, it's interesting in the Death Row.
I found Werner Herzog's voice a really chilling addition, because you have, throughout the entire documentary, you have the disembodied voice of Werner Herzog, and you because he has a very clipped German accent, it somehow comes across as very, very, very cold, and adds a very, very chilling effect to what is already an incredibly dark series of programmes. I watched it when it came out, and I found myself really uncomfortable on my sofa watching it, because it was an evening's entertainment, which is what television is often for. And I found myself transported to somewhere I really didn't want to be. And there were a couple of occasions when I just thought, actually, I have to stop this, because they're 45 minutes long. And a little bit of me was thinking, I don't know if the viewer can actually sustain 45 minutes of this. I think if he'd cut it down to 30, you could have got me right through. But maybe that's me with being impatient or wanting a little bit of levity at the end of the day. But I was gripped, but at the same time I was saying, please let this finish soon.
Well, it's probably deliberate on, you know, on the filmmaker's part, knowing they've got 40... I mean, quite often you're wanting to create a mood as a director, you know, with your editor and...
It reminded me of a series of documentaries. I don't know if you ever saw it, but it was a documentary on a Chinese television reporter who goes around filming the soon-to-be executed inmates of Death Row. And her job is to go around and do an in-depth interview with the to-be-soon-executed inmate, in which the inmate will confess their sins or can confess their guilt, express remorse, and then she will then drive to the scene of the murder and talk about it. And it because she was this very glamorous television presenter, it had a very slightly disjointed feel about it, because she was, you know, doing her makeup and making sure she looked great next to a place where someone had been hacked to death. And then obviously you had you had a lot more access into the Chinese jails. You saw them being marched out to their execution, although you never saw the point of death. And I found that actually a more satisfying documentary, because I found it more complex than the Werner Herzog. The Werner Herzog I found was very, very straightforward. It just told the story, but it didn't offer that much complexity in terms of your perception of what was going on.
I can see that. I quite like the space, you know, actually, that often you didn't know why they were sentenced to sentenced to death for half an hour. You know, you didn't know. Often there would be detailed descriptions about their last meal or the journey or something like that. But it's those kind of things, I think, that quite often are, to me, more interesting than just the simple black and white facts. Because the facts still come, you know, across the 45 minutes. But it's just, it's an interesting... It's one of these things with storytelling, you know, that instead of going A, B, C, D, you know, there might be a way of going D, B, A, and then chucking the C at the end or something, which I find interesting.
Let's move on to Project NIMH, the creation of James Marsh, who's a man who seems to be carving a career out of documenting the quirkier moments from the 1970s. He's the man behind Man on Wire, one of my favourite films. This is Project NIMH.
I thought, wouldn't it be exciting to communicate with a chimp and find out what it was thinking? So why not teach him sign language? And that's essentially why I started Project NIMH.
I know nothing about chimpanzees. Herb wanted me to take NIMH into my home as if he were a child. The fact that we could share language with an animal seemed very radical at that time.
There was no family discussion. It was just, oh, we're having a chimp. We're going to teach a sign language.
That was Project NIMH, the story of a chimpanzee in the 1970s, which they attempted to teach sign language to. It's an amazing little film. What did you think of it, Mark?
I loved it because, like the Werner Herzog film, it wasn't simple storytelling. Because in some ways, you know, probably the blurb on the back would say about this scientific experiment and this. That's the least important thing in a way, you know. Actually, what happens in the scientific experiment is, you know, just brushed over in a way. What's more interesting is how, and actually the chimpanzee, the
character. NIMH Chimpsky.
Brilliant name. I mean, yeah, he's the hero, but in many ways, the film is about the effect he has on the humans around him, and I thought that was fascinating, as you know, the emotional effect, and often big things were raised, but then just brushed over, instead of questioning or taking value judgments about things like the way that the chimpanzee was brought up by a human mother and stuff.
Nonetheless, it does explore the boundary between human and animal, and there's this lovely clip in the film where one of the people involved in the project was going, I was communicating with a different species, and she's still as baffled 30 years on as when it happened. There's also a little element in it of reconstruction, which is what he did in Man on Wire, and I was quite thrown by that because I was never sure what was real and what was reconstructed. What did you think of the use of reconstruction in Project NIMH?
Well, I agree. I thought I'd spotted the reconstructions, and then I saw the credits, you know, huge numbers of credits to do with chimp animatronics and this kind of thing. And I was like, wow, that's a serious budget. I mean, I've used reconstruction in my films. I'm not anti-reconstructions, as many of the quality broadsheets in the United Kingdom are, because actually you need pictures to tell stories.
There is that thing, if you haven't filmed it, it didn't happen. And that's a big problem.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes, you know, I find it difficult, annoying, if you're having to reconstruct something that's already been filmed, which people do. Do you know what I mean? In the 20th century, most things have been filmed. So if you start trying to reconstruct something that you've got can get archived for, I find that slightly silly. However, there are things that sometimes you need reconstructions for, like meetings that took place behind doors and then the action unfurled in front of cine cameras and stuff. Or secret things and stuff. But then the other thing is what I found interesting is that some of the the archive in Project NIMH is amazing. They've got a huge treasure trove of archive because the thing was obviously documented. There are times, I noticed one time when one of the handlers gets mauled quite badly, and they use reconstruction of blood landing on a basin, which is nicely done because it suddenly just punctuates it, because otherwise you've just got, you know, quite samey Super 8 cine archive, and it just, if you want, there's edit points and good cuts and things. It's quite nice to have just that colour and things like that.
And it's a good way of actually bringing in a moment, a very vivid moment to life. What I did find, though, even better, was when the handler lifted up the arm to show this, went, there's 37 stitches here. And you think that brought it home much, you know, as well as any reconstruction ever could.
Very much so. I also, what I liked about the reconstruction of this is that less is more, and I think that is a key in documentary. I frequently find that, you know, often people try and approach documentary reconstruction with a sort of drama or feature film sensibility. You know, you must get all the shots and must be wide, mid, close, and you're shooting it a bit like a soap opera. That's not what works in documentaries. It's actually interesting images like Blood on Basin or, you know, barley blowing in the wind or something, I think is often more interesting than just two actors in bad makeup talking to each other.
I don't know, there's something to be said for that. Mark Radice, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Our thanks to Mark Radice for coming in. You're listening to The Review. In a moment, we'll hear what the entertainment world has to offer this weekend.
The bumper December-January issue of Monocle takes a look over the horizon at 2013 and beyond, introducing you to the people you need to work with, giving you an insight into which nations are on the rise, spotlighting the best in retail, and letting you eavesdrop on conversations with the leaders in everything from foreign policy to trim typography. And there's much, much more.
This month in the culture section, we tour Asia in search of the continent's best cinemas, from Bangkok's Art Deco Scala Theatre to the Singapore cinema that feels more like a first-class plane cabin. We knock on the door of the Munich retirement home set up for the city's aging journalists, artists, actors and singers at one of the city's more enviable addresses. And we ask some of our favourite people what's on their Christmas wish list, from Danish songstress Oland to the Turkish author Elif Safak.
In the design section, we canvass the opinions of four giants from the world of graphic design. We also drop in on the UN headquarters in New York to see how the renovation of the council chamber is coming along. And we visit a perfect city bolt hole in Helsinki.
The December-January issue also includes our Turkey travel survey and is on sale now. Make sure you have all your holiday reading sorted. And remember, you can buy gift subscriptions at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove, and Emma Nelson. Time now to fill you in on some of the best the world has to offer in terms of weekend entertainment. Here's Nelly Gochiva.
This weekend in New York, the IFC Center celebrates the release of On the Road with a screening of a selection of road trip film classics. Showing on the weekend are Dennis Hopper's Easy Rider, John Ford's The Searchers, and The Motorcycle Diaries by Walter Salles himself. For more details, visit ifccenter.com. Stockholm's Fotografiska Museum hosts David LaChapelle's largest exhibition to date. The show includes more than 250 of LaChapelle's photos, music videos and films done in the past 25 years. Burning Beauty offers a glamorous yet sarcastic look at the world of fashion models and celebrities. It is on until the 3rd of March. Now open in Dallas is Perro Museum of Nature and Science, the latest project in the city's ever-growing downtown cultural district. Designed by Thom Mayne, the impressive five-story building is home to 11 permanent exhibition halls. There is also a 300-seat theater showing exciting new nature documentaries. For more details, go to parrotmuseum.org. This weekend, the Manier Gallery space in London's Southwark hosts the work of painter Josephine Lyons. Lyons's latest exhibition deals with the idea of memory and storytelling in art. Building on her previous shows and five previous books, Lyons has created a series of collages using layered text and paintings. The exhibit is on until the 22nd of December. And on our soundtrack this weekend are the XX. After the success of their latest album Coexist, the Brits are playing a cluster of dates in the UK and France. They'll be hitting London's Brixton Academy on Sunday, before two dates in Paris on Tuesday and Wednesday, then back to Brighton, UK, to finish on Thursday. All gig details can be found on the band's website, thexx.info. Let's hear Chained. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gocheva.
Separate to be closer than this. We used to get closer than this. Is it something you miss? We used to be closer than this. We used to get
and that was Chained by the XX.
Time now for our weekly music review here on The Review. Today we're talking to a man whose job it is to unearth the lost gems from the world of dance music, Quentin Scott from Strut Records. Welcome to Studio One here at Midori House. Tell us a little bit about Strut.
Thanks for having us along. Yeah, Strut has been going for a little while now. We founded it in 1999 and it's really about, broadly about the roots of dance music and all its different shapes and sizes. So it really covers everything from soul and funk through to world music, old African music, Latin music, and even into sort of post-punk and industrial music, that side of things. And it all kind of hangs together loosely as a label there.
Sounds great fun. So how do you go about sourcing your sort of portfolio in a way? It sounds like you have an enormous breadth when it comes to, you know, the genre even. What's your sort of remit in terms of sort of finding new labels to sign and also sort of gathering new archive from the past?
Yeah, it's more the in compilations, which is something we do a lot of. It's often a sort of a DJ or a producer that's got a particular vision for an album and we'll work with them on that. But there's also this whole, like in world music, for instance, there's a whole dynamic there at the moment, especially with the rise of the internet, where you get this new generation of diggers and collectors. And we kind of feed off that. You'll find there's this whole demand that suddenly goes around the collector circuit for a type of music.
There is an awful lot of music out there, though. How do you... Yeah. Choose the best bits?
I think it's just sort of knowing what's out there in the market and knowing what might work, really. I think it's a lot of it. So we don't have the money to do market research. It's all hunches, basically.
And in terms of, for instance, you mentioned that you have quite a lot of funk. Do you remaster stuff at Strut, or are you really just using the raw sort of 70s feel when you're looking at the funk labels that you might include?
I mean, if we do a funk compilation or a soul compilation or an even old world music compilation from the 70s, we always try and keep the original spirit of the music. We'll license it officially and then we'll try and find a master tape. If there's not a master tape available, we'll have to find a clean piece of vinyl, and that's often the case. And we just have these amazing mastering engineers who painstakingly take out all the clicks and make it sound incredible, but keep all the analog sort of grit and rawness to it.
Which, I was about to say, when do you say, actually, I need that click in? I need that little jump there, please, because it makes it sound like it should do.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I think the expectation with people buying records now is they want the rawness, but they don't want scratches all over it, basically. I mean, I think if you're doing a mixtape or something, that's fine. But for an official release, you always have to make it clean without taking away the spirit of the music. I think that's the way it works.
I mean, do you sometimes have wonderful moments of revelation when you find something from the 70s, for instance, that is just absolutely gold dust? I mean, it's so interesting that, especially with world music, you know, there's a slightly, if you dig around, you can find these really interesting groups. Like, we've been playing on Michael 24, this amazing duo from Lagos called the Lidaju Sisters.
Right.
And they're sort of like, it's a completely new sound from Nigeria at that time. And it's much more sort of funk and sort of reggae, really interesting swing to it that it isn't synonymous with Nigeria at all. It's almost been eclipsed by, you know, everything else that we associate with that. And is that something that, you know, you've delight in?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, that we did an album called Nigeria 70 back in about 2001, and that was a whole sort of revelation there. I think for a lot of people, they knew Fela Kuti and knew his, you know, his message in his music. But there was this whole scene there in the 70s where they were taking US funk and jazz and really sort of introducing it into traditional sounds. And all over Nigeria, you know, you'd have Lagos and you'd have the north where the Hausa communities are and the Igbo communities, and they'd all put their traditional music with funk, soul and jazz. And it just created some incredible fusions. And I think that's something we've always tried to explore is all those different strains. The Jadu Sisters were particularly brilliant because they just sound, it's just so off-kilter. Their harmonies are just one-offs. And there weren't actually that many female artists back then in the 70s. It was a quite an unusual thing for them to break through like that.
And identical twins to boot, by all accounts.
Yes.
We've had guests on here on the review before who come from the world of house music, and it's really obvious where you can go and hear that and where you can go and dance to it. But where can we hear this kind of music being played?
There are, I mean, there's quite a few labels doing this now, and they all have their own parties. We do sort of regular parties, which I think most of the time they've all got great websites which publicise these things. There's another label very similar to us called Soundway, who do some great African compilations.
Well, let's hear your first track.
Sure.
J.D. McDonald, Boogaloo Santa Claus.
That's a Babylon way, I heard a noise, and I bet you couldn't guess just what I saw. Ooh, yeah. I saw Boogaloo, Santa Claus. I saw Boogaloo, Santa Claus. I saw Boogaloo.
J.D. McDonald there and Boogaloo Santa Claus, the choice of Quinton Scott from Strut Records, our guest reviewer here on The Review on Monocle 24. Quinton, why did you choose that?
I mean, that's just a really interesting little sort of strain of music. Back in the 60s, there was the sort of Motown Christmas album, and James Brown did his Christmas albums, and these soul stars were sort of... you know, still doing Christmas records in amongst their normal output. And, you know, some of them were also sort of just hiding a few little messages in the lyrics as well. You'd sort of get some that would sort of say, you know, tell Santa to go straight to
the ghetto,
you know, that's it, and all that kind of thing. And it's, you know, but this one's a bit more lighthearted. I mean, he's getting Santa to do the popcorn and the funky chicken and all of that by the Christmas tree. And it was just, you know, I thought, we're coming up to the festive season. Let's have a bit of that one.
That's great. But, I love Boogaloo as a concept. It's probably the best.
Most unexplored concept. So, yeah,
it has
a sort of, 24.
It definitely has a sort of onomatopoeia going on. For some reason, you just feel like it means you've got to do something. But it's the genre as well. I mean, is this what he's doing with Santa? What's he doing to Santa?
It was just the age of the dance crazes, wasn't it? There were a lot of different ones. And the Boogaloo was very much a Latin American thing. It was a sort of New York. It was a little strain for a couple of years where the sort of Latin musicians were creating the Boogaloo sound. And it sort of bled over to soul music as well. And, you know, it just became a bit of a theme for a while, I think.
Well, let's head on to your next choice, which is from Addis Ababa, Mulata Astake, with Tilahun Gesese. Thank you for bringing in an easily pronounceable name there. Thank you, Quinton. Tell us a little bit about this piece of music before we hear it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a fascinating story. I mean, Mulatu is a one-off artist, really. He's he's really known as the father of Ethio jazz. And he basically... learnt the vibraphone and percussion and spent some time in New York. So he always had a very different vision for music to a lot of other Ethiopian artists. And this particular track is with one of the great Ethiopian vocalists, Tilahun Gesese, who's no longer with us, unfortunately. But really part of, I really can't claim the curatorship of this one. This is really all due to Francis Falsetto, who's an amazing French guy who developed the Ethiopique album series. Which is just a phenomenal piece of work, really just many volumes of great Ethiopian music, which must have been an utter headache to put together. So this is one track that we then compiled a Mulatu album and have worked with him a lot since on his studio albums and touring. So this is one of his great records.
Mulatu Astake there, a fantastic Addis institution, really. I mean, he's really a sort of titan of the music scene there. I've been reporting in Addis Ababa a couple of times, and, you know, you see that he's almost a godlike status. We don't really get a sense of that in the West, well, in the UK, you know, how enormous he actually is. Do you try and sort of convey that to your audience? And have you been out to Addis yourself to sort of see the scene there?
I have. No, I have been out. I've been very lucky to go there for a trip with him, just because he was very keen to sort of show where his influences were from. You know, the Coptic Church out there, and there's a lot of different things that go into his music. But I think, yeah, I mean, he is a hero out there. But I think right now he's been so successful over the last few years. He's touring relentlessly now, really, around the world, and also doing a lot of lecturing on how Ethiopian music has influenced Western music. You know, there's a lot of parallels, like the kettle drum originally comes from an Ethiopian drum, and you know, priests use conducting sticks, which is very much a sort of a forerunner of the way classical music works. And there's all these great links which he's very keen to put across in amongst, you know, doing his own music.
Quinton Scott, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. That was Quinton Scott from Strut Records. You with a review.
Time now to visit a city around the world to find out about cultural happenings in the coming days. Today we're off to San Francisco, where our guide is Monocle correspondent Alistair G.
With Christmas approaching in San Francisco, you can go skating on Union Square in the shade of palm trees and grab an ice cream on one of the not infrequent warm days. You can also enjoy an array of enticing performances and events. Beginning today, there are three performances of the San Francisco 1 Minute Play Festival. 40 Bay Area playwrights, such as Joan Holden, a Tony Award-winning writer for the San Francisco Mime Troupe, will be showing their playlets at the Thick House Theatre. To get into the Christmas spirit, you can head down to the California Academy of Sciences in Golden Gate Park. In the piazza, alongside the indoor rainforest and aquarium, visitors can enjoy a twice-hourly artificial snow flurry. There are also performances of Eskimo storytelling and dance, and reindeer will be trotting around. On Tuesday at the Makeout Room, you can attend Fight Club, or did I mean Write Club, which is billed as literary blood sport. Six authors will engage in a write-off and have 7 minutes to craft a defense of one side in debates such as Jesus versus Santa and give versus receive. The audience will judge the results. Also around the city are exhibitions about ballet dancer Rudolf Nureyev and artist Jasper Johns. But your cultural week in San Francisco wouldn't be complete without a drag show, this one by the famous girls from Tranny Shack. Following on from their performances of episodes of Sex and the City and Roseanne, they're reenacting Christmas episodes of Golden Girls through the end of the month. What better way to kick off the holiday season than with their cleaner, cookie dough, and Pollo Del Mar?
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. It's Saturday, so here we are with Emma, with Sophie Grove and me, Emma Nelson. We head now to Barcelona to meet a young couple whose love for words stretch far beyond their full-time jobs in translation. They decided to open a bookshop specialising in narrative fiction, and Monocle's Liam Aldous went along to meet them.
It was a bunch of little things. Basically, my girlfriend and me were kind of sick of been working for third parties, and in the last 5 years working more and more and more and for less and less money. So we got fed up one night after dinner, and we were fantasizing about what do we have to stand this when all we would like would be to live in an island or to have a small bookshop we said a lot of nonsense that night. But the thing with the small bookshop kept in the back of our minds. Then we talked about it the next day, then the other. Then what was a plain fantasy turned into a reality. Well, this is a small bookshop. So from day one, we decided to specialize in narrative fiction. But what I mean by this is that we don't cover nonfiction. We don't cover sci-fi. We don't cover self-help books. So once we picked our specialization, which was fiction, we split the bookshop almost physically in a new book section and a used second-hand book section.
So what's the book we're holding at the moment?
The title is Beer in the Snooker Club by Weji Gali. I think that's how you say it. I'm not sure. And Weji Gali is an English writing Egyptian writer though he is not actually a writer. He just was a guy who happened to write a novel, which went into oblivion very quickly when it was released around '60s, something like that. At least here in Spain, it's been recovered by a small independent publisher, Sahalin Books. There are many of these in Spain these years, the last 10 years. There's been very many independent publishers, young people, which are doing an incredible archaeology job in recovering forgotten books that should never be forgotten. This one is a good example, Beer in the Snooker Club from Wedgie Gully. It's pretty much autobiographical, though it's a fiction work, about an Egyptian guy, an Egyptian young man, raised in a rich family in the Nasser era of Egypt and the revolution and the socialist push and a political and social situation where they had to make a stand. Young people had to make a stand. Then the Ram, which is the main character in this book, is pretty much divided among his rich kid roots, his very Anglophile background, because he went to study to England, and a girlfriend. There is always a girlfriend in a good fiction book, and they mess things up, and her girlfriend is a revolutionary. So he's kind of split between his roots and his desire to do something so silly as to impress her girlfriend. This all is wrapped in a very, very, very exquisite narrative with a very fine irony and sense of humor. And it's really a very funny book to read, though the subject is not fun at all, actually.
It's very relevant for the contemporary Egypt as well.
Completely. Yeah, you can relate to him completely, even if the action happens 50 years back.
That's always a good sign of a good novel.
Yeah.
It's timelessness.
The next book is from a Spanish author, which has been one of the surprises in the Spanish letters recently. His name is Javier Pérez Andújar. He is actually a journalist for El País and some other large headers. And he's wrote three novels, of which I'm going to recommend the last one. It's Walks with My Mother, Paseos con Mi Madre. I don't think it's published in English or will be anytime soon. And it's a beautiful story, half fiction, half essay, half memories of his life, his youth in the outskirts of Barcelona. And it's a very, very wise and polite, but yet very tough criticism to how Barcelona, which is the traditionally the open arms city, and it's very open to a tourist with money. It's not so open to her sons and daughters in the outskirts, in the poorest suburbs in Barcelona. And it's a very lyrical writing because Andújar is really a poet, though he doesn't know, but he is, because his images are so vivid, and it's a tough book to read, because basically the idea behind it all, once you close it, is how close you live to downtown Barcelona and yet how far.
And that was Pere Fernandez from Pecod Books in Barcelona, speaking with Monocle's Liam Aldous.
And that brings us to the end of the Saturday Review. For now, it's goodbye from us all here at Midori House. Our show was produced by Dawn Trump and Katie Bilboa and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch.
Tune in for the latest edition of Culture with Robin Bound if you fancy some more culture, and that's at 1900 hours London time on Monday.
We're handing back over to Georgina Godwin with the weekend edition next. You can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time. You've been listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Sophie Grove. Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.